Hi everyone, I'm Stephen Downs. Welcome to another edition of Ethics, Analytics, and the Duty of Care. And this is approaching the end of Module 5 on Approaches to Ethics with the appropriately titled video, The End of Ethics. And what I want to talk about here are two related questions. One is, what is the goal or the objective of ethics? What are we ultimately trying to do here with this whole inquiry? And second, how or why do we conclude our discussion of ethics? How ultimately does it end? When can we put this down and move on with our lives? We're going to find that these questions aren't exactly straightforward. We might think of this video as meta-ethics, and of course we could go on into infinity asking this sort of question. But at the same time, I think we do have a responsibility to sit back and question just what were the presumptions that we had going into this. Not methodological presumptions, not presumptions about values or states of affairs, but presumptions about the nature of the inquiry itself. And you know, we think of ethics when we think of it at all as, you know, a universalist sort of thing. We think that what we're after are ethical principles or ethical statements or what have you that apply to everybody. It takes us back to the early days of Solon's Law Code. And, you know, the intuition that we have that ethical principles ought to be the same for everyone. And yet, at the same time, we know that they're not. if anything, the recent pandemic has shown us that. At the start of the pandemic, everybody liked to say, well, we're all in the same boat. But as time went by, it became clear that, well, we may have all been in the same storm. We were certainly in different boats. And some boats were nice big cruise liners. Other boats were handy-dandy sailing boats. That's kind of what I was in, I think. Other boats were leaky rowboats and those refugee boats filled with people trying to find a better way. And some people, a lot of people, didn't have a boat at all. And the same is true with ethics. I'm quoting from Gelman and Adler Bell here, members of our most disadvantaged communities have long asserted that they fall under heavier and more hostile scrutiny, and empirical research supports them. And it's not just empirical research. I mean, you just have to look at the news to see that there's one standard for one type of person and another standard for another type of person. Yesterday, a white kid who went out and shot some people got off. Or not shot some people, I think. No, this case was the admitted rapist who got off without any jail time. As compared to the poor young black kid who's serving years in jail for a minor case of shoplifting. Now, that's not one ethics that rules them all. And we know that this is the case. And it's foolish to pretend otherwise. What about character? We think we have in ethics something like an understanding of what it would be to be an ethical person. But, you know, when we look at the actual principles of exceptional character or ethical attributes, these lists vary considerably. I've been involved with a project called CoVDA, and character is at the center of some of the things that are being put forward by project members. And again, it's a different list. So, you know, is resilience part of the character? Is collaboration part of the character? Compassion, contemplation, loyalty, justice, initiative? Ask different people, you get different answers. You know, there are all kinds of different ways of coming up with what you think are ethical characters. Is spirituality part of an ethical character, for example? Is generosity and sharing part of an ethical character? Or is entrepreneurship and competitive edge? You know, there are no answers here. And there's not going to be a simple way to break them apart. And even more to the point, we find some character attributes more valued in some cases, in some people, in some types of people, than in others. The character attributes that we value, or say we value, or at least are represented well in media for people like Elon Musk, for example, are very different from those that we might value in the current president, or in a person like me, a humble public servant. So, what are we up to here, really? Look at how we approach some of these fundamental ethical principles. Like, for example, killing is wrong. It's right there in the Christian Bible, right? Thou shalt not kill. Except in some translations, the wording is, thou shalt not murder. Well, that's a very different thing, right? And in one case you have, thou shalt not kill. On the other hand, you have, thou shalt not kill without the proper paperwork. Two very different things. But, you know, there seems to be a lot of wiggle room in this prohibition against killing, right? For self-defense, maybe it's okay. Florida and other states in the U.S. have the Stand Your Ground law, which lets you basically shoot people who are trespassing. What about war? All nations virtually either participate or have shown a willingness to participate in war, and one of the salient features of war is people get killed. Or what about euthanasia? Again, you know, in Canada now, euthanasia is permitted under the law. There are conditions, of course, but there can be physician-assisted deaths. So, you know, we say, or some people say, killing is an absolute moral principle, but really, not so much. And again, doesn't apply to all the people all the time in the same way. Certainly, we look, there are whole classes of people, for example, police, for whom killing seems to be permissible and, you know, something that's likely to happen on the job. But again, not all police are like this either. What do we say about killing? We don't have a thing that we can say about killing. Similarly with lying. You know, the general perception is that honesty is the best policy. In fact, there's even a saying to that effect. But the facts are, we lie. A lot. And we don't even know why. You know, I was sitting in my office at the NRC building before the pandemic hit, maybe a year or so before. And our business development officer walked in. I hadn't seen him for a while. He looks at my bookshelf and goes, yeah, lots of books. And I said, yep, and I've read them all. No, it's not true. I'd read a lot of them, you know, but I hadn't read them all. Why did I say that? Now, I've wondered ever since what the point, I mean, I said it before I even thought about it. And he, of course, responded, oh, you read Das Kapital? And I said, well, I use that as a reference work. You know, why? Why would I lie? But I do. We all do, to more or less a degree. Maybe there's a person who has never lied in their life. I don't know who it is. And we don't have the same view about all of these lies. I thought that particular lie was wrong, although no harm was caused by it. And there, you know, and perhaps maybe it was wrong because it was so transparently a lie. maybe it was wrong because it was a bad lie. And we hear about white lies and so on, and we hear about lying, which is deceitful, duplicitous, etc. There are all kinds of reasons why we at least rationalize our lying. Spying. There's a lot of talk in the world of AI and analytics about surveillance, and the general tenor of the discussion is it's wrong. But it's not clear to me at all that people would agree that it's wrong, even those who are saying it's wrong. One of the big problems with offshore banking and tax havens is that everything there happens in secret. And so the fact that most of all money is hidden away seems to be a problem. At least to me, it seems to be a problem. And when we get releases of, say, the Panama Papers, which reveal this duplicitness, we can see that the release of these papers was a good thing. Or the actions of people like Chelsea Manning or Edward Snowden or even Julian Assange in releasing private information and revealing things like, for example, torture at Abu Ghraib. And, spying and releasing information about torture seems to me to be a good thing. Or, to make it a bit more prosaic, using cameras or doorbell cameras to spot people who are committing crimes seems like a good plan. Now, that's not to say all cases of spying are good, and it's not to say all justifications of spying are good. The old saying, if you haven't done anything wrong, you have nothing to fear, does not hold up as a justification for anything. If you're saying that, really, what you're saying is, well, I don't care if it happens to other people. I mean, I'm not worried because bad things aren't happening to me. But there isn't a single principle, a single prohibition against spying. And this suggestion that ethics somehow simply bans surveillance is wrong and misleading. Why do we assume this is what we're up to, trying to come up with that sort of principle? I think, a lot of this comes down to what's called axiology. Axiology, it's from the Greek word axia, meaning value or worth, and then logia, the study of. It's the philosophical study of value. What matters to us? And it's more than just financial value, although, of course, in today's society, where the capital ethos has run rampant, everything is reduced to financial value. But we can imagine, at least, other kinds of values or other ways of things being valued. One's own life, for example. You're probably not going to exchange that for money. So it has a value that is not a financial value. Axiology looks at what are called intrinsic and extrinsic values. Intrinsic is the value a thing has in and of itself. So, when Kant says to treat people as ends and not means, what he's saying is people have an intrinsic value in and of themselves. Extrinsic value is value is assigned by external factors or external people. The principle of supply and demand is a mechanism for calculating extrinsic value, right? The value of a commodity isn't in the commodity itself. It's in what people will pay in order to acquire that commodity. Substantive theories of value try to determine which entities, and we use the word entities very loosely here, have intrinsic value. Whether they have just one intrinsic value, the hedonist saying happiness is everything, is an example of a monist intrinsic value, versus pluralists like the character theorists that I've talked about, thinking that there are numerous different ways something can have value. And then, of course, there's the nihilist. Nothing has value. What any examination of value will show, and we looked a bit at values when we looked at ethical codes, shows that there's a wide range of things that can be considered determinate of value or values in and of themselves. Everything from happiness to peace to contentment to joy to good character to harmony to money to life to whatever, right? Free time, freedom, liberty, etc. All of these words are all different values, and we can combine them, mix them, remix them, and throwing that into our analysis of ethics doesn't make it clearer, it makes it muddier. Because, here we are trying to determine what's right and wrong, and we don't even know what the basis is for counting what's right and what's wrong. It's a problem that we see a lot in the study of education generally, actually. People say, this method is a success, that method is a success. But the question comes up, what does success look like in education? Is it getting a job? Is it learning how to live the good life? Is it achieving satisfaction? Is it the pursuit of inquiry? Is it staying out of jail? All of these things could be thought of as legitimate outcomes of an education. And when we say, this educational practice has been successful, success is measured against some of those, but which ones it's measured against depends really on your point of view. And, it's the same sort of thing for ethical theory, right? An ethical theory is successful, measured against some metric of value. But it depends, on what you think is valuable, whether you think an ethical theory is successful. So we could maybe recast ethics. I mean, the current inquiry seems to be, more and more breaking into more and more different parts. Maybe let's try this on for a hypothesis, thinking of ethics as a branch of something else. And we certainly have many different divisions of ethics: bioethics, business ethics, environmental ethics, etc. And then the different aspects of each of these, the clinical research, research allocation, etc. And each of those determines in its own way what is valuable and what will count as evidence for that value and how we obtain the evidence for that value and to what sort of question those calculations of value will be put. So, it's just like natural philosophy used to encompass all of what we call today science, broke down into physics, chemistry, biology, for example, looking at different domains, asking different questions, using different methods to get evidence. You don't use a microscope to do astrophysics. It just wouldn't make any sense. The unit of parsecs pretty much never comes up in biology. That measure of distance just isn't appropriate. And so maybe what we think of ethics really breaks down into these different divisions. And we've done enough research now to know this. And we can look at these more particular applications. Certainly a philosophy based on ethical codes seem to presuppose something like this. So let's try that out as a hypothesis. Well, maybe ethics is a matter of social development. Amartya Sen, for example, talks about evaluating the value of government against the concrete capabilities of the citizen, right? So instead of using something transcendental and institutional like Rawls's theory of justice, Really what you need to do is look at something that is both comparative and realizations oriented. An example in the Wikipedia article that I'm citing here suggests, for example, citizens must have functionings to have a capacity to vote. For example, they need to be literate. They need to have some idea of knowing what the options are. They need to have transportation to the polling place. They need to be able to satisfy in a reasonable manner the conditions for voting. All of these things come into a definition of ethics, if by ethical you mean democratic, right? And you can't just say, well, you know, you have this principle of fairness. Fairness doesn't make sense when the lived experience of people is so different. It goes back to some of our earlier slides. You know, the actual principles that apply to some people are different than others. It's just that instead of saying, well, sure, the rich have their own system of ethics and whatever, Sen kind of turns that upside down and says, you know, if we're going to give anyone latitude in ethics, it should be poor people, right? And they acquire, if you will, and I'm kind of really paraphrasing and putting my own interpretation on this here, but if you're going to hold people accountable, ethically accountable at all, you have to increase their capacity, increase their functionings so that they can act as ethical agents. It's very similar to what Martha Nussbaum would call a capabilities approach. Maybe ethics is a branch of critical theory, or maybe there's at least a type of ethics that is a branch of critical theory. In the US these days, there's a big debate about critical race theory, which was defined by Roy L. Brooks in 1994 as, and I quote, a collection of critical stances against the existing legal order from a race-based point of view. And it's the idea here that race is ultimately a social construct. It's not a natural kind. And I think there's plenty of evidence for that. You can say, well, yeah, it's obvious you have black people and white people. But, I mean, it's not obvious. We talk about, say, African Americans, which don't actually include Aboriginals living in Australia or even black people living in Canada. Race is a social construct. You look at the difficulties they had in South Africa distinguishing between members of different races and having to go to deep genetic analysis in order to try to come to some sort of distinction. But the problem is, race doesn't break down genetically. They're not genetic characteristics. They're superficial color-based characteristics, or, you know, the shape of your ears or your nose or whatever. The second point of critical race theory is that racism isn't merely an individual bias or prejudice, but is rather embedded in the legal system. We could talk a lot about that, and we should say that it is not merely embedded in the legal system, but is embedded in institutional systems generally, which is the point of this cartoon here, where the one person says, the child says, "You got me the wrong history book. This one not only has slavery in it, but it says it was bad." The idea that, there are ways of teaching children that institutionalize in their mind a certain race-based way of looking at the world where race is attached to value is an inherent part of critical race theory. And that's how the racism is supplemented with policies and procedures, everything from preferential policing to presumption of innocence and guilt to whether it's okay to shoot them. The core here, though, is not so much to question whether racism is bad, right, which would seem to be the ethical issue, but rather to talk about how interpretations of the ethical principle are embedded in our social and institutional structures. Now, that isn't something that they teach in school, but maybe it should be. We can look at large swaths of instances of structural discrimination, and, you know, again, it makes ethics into something like social political analysis discourse, again, rather than the question of whether something is right or wrong. And, you know, we look at matters of fact in our community, and we see evidence of this. For example, there's a BBC report titled "Why Hard Work Alone Isn't Enough to Get Ahead," and the reason why is, and I quote, "You need to be liked by people at your level, by people above you, and by people below you." But being liked isn't something that is in the control of any particular individual. For example, if you are ugly, however ugliness is defined, you are less likely to be liked. If you are of one gender or another, one race or another, this will have a bearing on whether you are liked. So the principle, which isn't really a principle, because nobody would say it's an ethical principle that you need to be liked, but this principle in practical applications has ethical consequences on the actions of people in workplaces and in society. You know, a lot of times these ethical concerns are very tightly bound to context. In Canada, we had a case where military leaders, and I quote, "saw pandemic as unique opportunity to test propaganda techniques on Canadians." And you sort of think, in what context is that ethically appropriate? That was certainly my reaction. But clearly, it was felt to be appropriate by at least certain members of the Canadian military. It's like, oh, look at this situation. This is a great way to test such and such. You know, we can find out whether our techniques are working. And it may have just simply been an operational procedure and not even thought of as an ethical issue. And that's how ethics becomes structural. When you no longer think of it in ethical terms, you're thinking of it in management terms, corporate terms, military terms, and so ethics kind of disappears into this management and institutional policy. Maybe that's good, but just as often, it could be bad. All of these suffer against what I call the Joker problem. The Joker problem is summed up in a phrase from The Dark Knight. Some men just want to watch the world burn, right? And it's increasingly hard to say why they're wrong. You know, in our society, we allow that there are different motivations, and we allow that there are different virtues. But in some cases, there are people that have no virtue, at least none that we would recognize. And the thing is, we see them as unethical, but there really isn't any ethical principle, properly so called, that their overall approach of wanting to see the world burn denies. Take that and put that into a concrete, practical situation, and you have what's known as the Byzantine General's problem. There's a little diagram here and a link to a description of it. It plays a major role in blockchain systems. And the Byzantine General's problem is essentially you have the Byzantine emperor, who is engaged in a war, because they always were, with various generals reporting to him. Now, communication was horrible in those years. And so it was hard to get messages from the generals to the leader. But the general, the leader needs to know whether the generals think that he should attack or retreat. But the thing is, in the Byzantine Empire, the general can, and sometimes wants to, undermine the leader and become emperor himself. So in a situation where the leader should retreat, the general advises attacking, hoping that the leader will attack and be destroyed. And then that's confused by the fact that the leader would like a consensus of opinions from all of the generals, but some of the generals want to undermine him, and sometimes some generals report on what other generals are saying. So one general might say, well, the other two generals also said attack, and I say attack, so we should attack, when in fact, only one of them said attack. You see the problem, right? You just can't trust your generals. Well, it's like the Joker. You just can't trust the Joker. But that's the world we live in, right? A lot of ethics is based on the idea of creating trust. A mechanism that allows us to interoperate, to not kill each other, etc. But the Joker problem tells us that we need to make it about more than just trust. In fact, what they're trying to do in blockchain is to create trust-free or trustless mechanisms for commerce. Now, if we could do that in financial commerce, maybe we could do that in other areas. Certainly, it is the case that whatever we think of as ethics doesn't seem to apply in the financial community. That's why you need solutions like this. But maybe it doesn't apply either in the wider society. And maybe there are just jokers walking among us, and no matter what ethical principle we have, it's not going to be enough to solve the problem. Maybe indeed ethics is nothing more than a technical problem. We see a lot of work being done in contemporary artificial intelligence and machine learning, addressing ethical issues as technical problems to be addressed by the best model, where the best model is determined by challenges or competitions. And Barry DeBrun and others say competition has historically had a great impact on bringing the attention of the research community to a particular problem and in attracting new researchers to the areas. Ethics is one of those problems. So, for example, I got some links here, a competition on gendered pronoun resolution, or vision challenges, or inclusive images challenge, etc., right? So, really, if we just put it open to competition and had different AI teams work on the ethical problem, maybe that would resolve the issue of ethics for us. Now, intuitively, that doesn't seem like a good idea, but observationally, that's what people are doing. And, you know, it's hard to say why they're wrong. Or maybe ethics really is just a commercial market waiting to develop. Certainly seeing a lot of that these days. I have a number of examples in my deeper text, but here's a simple one where the company Accenture has come out with what they call the Accenture Fairness Tool, which enables a user to identify and fix some of the problems that result in unfair outcomes by analyzing both training data and models. Congratulations, Accenture, you have solved ethics. Well, I think, and I'm quoting here from quite a nice paper written by David Weinberger just the other day, Although he says he's been working on it for 2 years, and maybe that's true. To pull out a few salient quotes, when people say we don't know how machine learning works, what we're hearing, and we should hear perhaps, is that these models do indeed work. And the reason why they work is that they're better at reading the world than we are. The big problem that a lot of people have with the ethics of analytics and machine learning is that they're not explainable. You can't take the decision of a machine learning model and express in plain words the sort of thinking that the machine learning went through to reach the conclusion that it did. But that's what we would expect of a human, right? We ask, you know, how did you reach the decision that this action was right? Well, I thought this and I relied on that principle. You know, that's what we ask humans to do. But you can't ask that of the machine, because the machine isn't able to just sit there and start rationalizing the way a human can. And what we learn, I think, from what we see in the world of artificial intelligence today is not that there aren't generalizations, laws, or principles. There certainly are. It's observationally true that they are, that there are. But it's a denial of the idea that they are sufficient for understanding what happens in a universe as complex as ours. These ethical principles that we're trying to get at, perhaps to explain what it is we're thinking when we decide that some behavior is good, some character trait is bad. We're trying to pull out these principles, and we do pull out these principles, but they are just not sufficient. As I say, the words are too blunt an instrument for the fine-tuned knowledge that they're trying to represent. And we see lots of efforts to uncover simple universal principles, but they're just not sufficient. Jones writes, implementation must deal with interdependent problems navigating non-linear and often unpredictable change processes involving a diverse range of stakeholders. Even the factors in that sentence are enough to make an environment unknowable in any sense that we understand as knowable. The capacities to tackle these problems are often distributed across a number of different people. No one person can actually address these. Also, they're complex systems, so the actual outcomes are unpredictable. It's like the weather, right? And even worse, these complex problems often involve conflicting goals, or conflicting values, or conflicting principles, etc. So the simple universal solutions that we're hoping for from ethics are not going to apply here. So what does that mean? I think it means the end of ethics, properly so-called. I think that we should stop thinking of ethics in the sense of pulling out some sort of abstract principles, universal or not, based on abstract values. Though we can derive these universal principles, we should not. I quote from Douglas Rushkoff here. The only real weapon against the fearful vision of a cold cyber-Siberia is joy. Appreciation of the space gives the surfer his bearings and balance in Siberia. That's kind of a complex idea, and it was quite prescient for Rushkoff to be writing in that way in 1994. But, you know, the world of ethics is a lot like the world of surfing. It's a lot like the world of living in Siberia, the real Siberia, where it's really hard to see what sort of principles are going to matter next. Because it's really hard to see what's going to happen next. Maybe the wave changes. Maybe the storm front comes on you unexpectedly. Maybe you suddenly find yourself running aground. Maybe you suddenly find yourself in the deep freeze. Whatever, right? And what ethics needs to be in these kind of environments is this joyful apprehension of the environment and appreciation of the environment. Good is something that we bring to the world. It's not something that was in the world, it's something that we bring to the world. And instead of thinking of ethics as, you know, some kind of stern sentinel that tells us what we ought or ought not do, we should be thinking of ethics as how it is that we find and or define or recognize what is truly good in the world, what makes our existence not merely bearable, but the wondrous thing that it is. Now, the question of how we do that is a hard question. And we're going to look at some approaches to this in the next module of the course. The next module of the course is the duty of care. And it sounds like I'm going back to that stern taskmaster again with the word duty. But really, the idea of care is about the idea of nurturing and about the idea of relationships. And it has its basis in a feminist principle of ethics, but it doesn't end with a feminist principle of ethics. And it's an approach that helps us understand how we can describe and bring out and comprehend the way we are related to the rest of the world and why we are able to find good in that. So I'll leave you with that for now, and I'll see you next week. I'm off to go watch a football game in Montreal, trying to find the good in everything, even a last-place team on their final game of the year. So have a good weekend, and thanks for now. I'm Stephen Downs. I'll talk to you next time.